Great to be back again. I believe it was Richard Hofstadter, the sociologist, who said that many developments have affected the way we live far more than evolution did. But none have affected more in ways of thinking and believing. And he went on to say, in that respect, the space age does not promise even remotely to match it. How does evolution affect our way of thinking? I recall one time when there was a balanced treatment statute that had been adopted, and I believe that was the Arkansas case, and Kelly Seagraves, a creationist activist out in California, was on Phil Donahue's program to defend the idea of teaching a two-model approach to creation and evolution, and he was asked a question by Donahue. The question was, why are you so upset about just a couple of lines in a biology textbook? And then they went to a commercial, and Seagraves never did get a full opportunity to address that. But what I hope we can do today here is demonstrate why understanding and refuting the Darwinian worldview is essential to a proper understanding of constitutional law. Let's begin by saying that the founding fathers had a clear concept of truth in their minds, and this is a concept that the deists would have held just as strongly as the Christians. For both of them, the idea was that truth is absolute, it is unchanging, and it is ordained by God. That's clear in the Old Testament, where the Hebrew word for truth is emeth, meaning that which is fixed, that which is constant, that which stands the test of time. And by the way, if you're wondering where you might have heard that word emeth, if you read C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, you may recall the Calormene soldier who seems to be worthy of a god much better than Tosh, and Aslan accepts him, that his name was emeth, and not many people realize that's where the name comes from. In the New Testament, the view is even stronger there, that truth there is equated with Jesus Christ. In fact, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And saying I am, probably speaking in Aramaic, he would have been using a word very similar to Yahweh, God, the way, the truth, and the life. Notice he didn't say that I will show you the truth. He said I am the truth. And he didn't say I am a truth. And there's another truth in Muhammad, and another in Hare Krishna, and another in the Bhagavad Gita and other sources. I am the truth. And to make clear that he was making that an absolute, and to make it exclusive, he said, no man cometh unto the Father but by me. We read further in the book of Hebrews, and I won't even say who the author of the book of Hebrews is. After having taught it a number of times, I honestly don't know, and I think Tertullian answered it correctly way back in 200 AD when Tertullian said, who wrote the book of Hebrews is known only to God. And I think I have to leave it there. But in the book of Hebrews, we read Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Okay, so if Jesus is the truth, and if Jesus doesn't change, then it follows that truth doesn't change. Its applications may change in some ways, but truth itself does not. And that's the way the founding fathers understood truth. But this was to change as we move into the 1800s. And I could give a lengthy course on Philosophy 101 and see the various changing definitions of truth. That Hegel, for example, with his idea that truth is a matter of becoming, not being, as he put it, you have a basic thesis over here that is the idea for one generation, and then an antithesis, an opposite idea arises, like maybe this is capitalism, this is socialism, and the tension between them, out comes a synthesis, which is the best of both. It could just as easily be the worst of both, but the best of both, which might be democratic socialism, and that becomes the thesis for the next age, and another antithesis arises, and so truth changes over the years. And after Hegel's death, Hegel was not so much talking about Christianity as he was about the way we learn how to believe and know things. And there are some who think that Hegel was an atheist, others who think he was a Christian, and you could make an argument for either. In fact, after he died, the followers of Hegel kind of divided into two camps. You had the left Hegelians that went off into socialism and communism and things like that. Then you had the right Hegelians who tried to reconcile Hegel's thought with Christianity. And in fact, they would even say that Christianity was the ultimate example of the dialectic, that in Christianity you have the thesis over here that God is a God of judgment and justice. You have the antithesis over here, that God is the God of love. The synthesis comes in the cross, where God's justice and God's love meet. Well, that may have been something that has some validity to it, and I can kind of imagine Hegel coming back from the grave and listening to that and say, hey, that's great, I wish I'd thought of that. But at any rate, that's a step that leads to another area, and that's what we're going to call Darwinism. Now, you could describe Darwin's idea of origins, and it's a lot more than just that. It's a worldview. Darwin is certainly not the first person in the world to ever come up with a theory of evolution, but his contribution was that he explained natural selection as the means by which evolution takes place. The way you'd summarize Darwin's thought, purely in terms of scientific theory, is first of all, you have overproduction of species. You start out with two rabbits, and then you've got four rabbits, and 8 million rabbits, and 8 billion rabbits, and so overproduction of species. But the problem is, we have limited resources. Let's say in this county, we have 1 million rabbits living in this county, but this county's vegetation and terrain can only support 500,000 rabbits. Well, that means half of those rabbits are going to survive and half of them are not. Well, which ones are going to survive and which ones aren't? That's where we get the next part of the theory. After overproduction, a struggle for survival. The rabbits are struggling among themselves to see who is going to get those last morsels of food and who is not. And of course, the struggle is broader than that. Rabbits are struggling against foxes and all sorts of other animals as we see the struggle for survival going on. And in this struggle, some are going to survive and some aren't. Well, which ones are going to survive? The ones who are going to survive are the fittest. Survival of the fittest. Now, who are the fit rabbits? Well, that might depend on the needs of the time, but maybe the smartest ones, maybe the fastest ones, maybe the ones that have the best protective coloring, or maybe the ones that have the heaviest coats so they can stand the winter, or the lightest coats so they can survive the summer, or maybe the ones that are the most disease resistant. But the fit rabbits are going to survive. The unfit rabbits are not. And classical Darwinism really had a dilemma here because it engaged in circular reasoning, and classical Darwinism simply defined fitness as ability to survive. So which rabbits survive? Well, the fittest. Which are the fittest? The ones that survive. Which are the ones that survive the fittest, and so on. But you could refine that a little bit. Okay, so the next part is reproduction of like kind. Not only does that mean that rabbits are going to produce rabbits and squirrels are going to produce squirrels, but it means that fit rabbits are going to produce fit baby rabbits. Smart rabbits are going to produce, on the average, smart baby rabbits. Long-legged rabbits will, on the average, produce long-legged baby rabbits and the like. And so the species changes gradually with time, becomes more and more fit, and some might even accept that and say that's microevolution, change within a species, but Darwin will go a step further and say that there's also macroevolution, that is, change from one species to another, and eventually that rabbit is going to evolve into a higher form of life, and an ape-like creature is ultimately going to evolve into a primitive human being, and ultimately into mankind as we know it today. And in this view, there's no reason to think that we are anything more than just the latest step on this gradual evolutionary scale. Well, that's Darwinism, then, in a nutshell. And I think it's a false worldview. One of the things that I think does a very good job of refuting it is the lack of true missing links. And the one thing that can be said truly about the missing link is that if it exists, it is still missing. You hear discoveries from time to time, but I would have to say, from what I can see, that every creature that has ever been found that scientists have claimed to be a missing link can be explained as either an ape or as a human being, that no true missing links have ever been found. In fact, Darwin himself, shortly before he died, lamented the lack of any missing links, and he said, "What's bothering me here is that if my theory is correct, the fossil strata should be teeming with missing links. But we have not found one," he said. But then he went on to say, "But we can only trust that with time and research," and he should have added lots of taxpayers' federal money, "that these missing links will be found," which certainly demonstrates that evolutionists do not lack faith. But I'm much more concerned here today with Darwinism as a worldview, as a philosophy, as a way of thinking. And it leads to a rejection of the idea that truth is fixed, truth is absolute. It leads to the idea that truth, like everything else, is in flux, that truth is changing. And many took Darwin's ideas and made them into a worldview. There's probably nobody in history who took Darwin's ideas and made them into a worldview more than Herbert Spencer did in the latter half of the 1800s. Spencer was a very prolific writer, and it's been said that there is probably no writer on philosophy in history that ever had as wide a following as Spencer did in the late 1800s, and went on to say that even today, people who've never heard of Spencer have been greatly influenced by people who were influenced by Spencer. Spencer talked about the implications of Darwinism for anthropology, for psychology, for education, for religion, for economics, for government, sociology, and just about every other subject you could imagine. But many took Darwin's thought, applied it to various areas, and it's interesting that in economics, not only did Spencer use it to develop his theory of survival of the fittest, or laissez-faire capitalism, the big business, survival of the fittest, tooth and claw version of capitalism that we had in the late 1800s, all of which came out of a Darwinist worldview, and that is not true capitalism. True capitalism, as we would have seen it at Adam Smith a century earlier, and as our founding fathers would have believed in it, and as the Bible teaches it, true capitalism teaches a work ethic. It also teaches competition, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it also teaches a moral ethic that is totally lacking in Spencer's laissez-faire capitalism. Under laissez-faire capitalism, it is your duty as a businessman to drive your competitor out of business and force him to either work for you or starve, because in so doing, you are simply practicing survival of the fittest, and ultimately, the benefit is going to go to the human race as a whole. You're producing a product as a businessman, and you're selling it for a price, and then all of a sudden, another businessman comes along who makes that same product a little bit better, and or at a better price, and so he gets your business, Somebody else comes along that's still better, and ultimately the consumer is being benefited by more and more choices and better products and better prices. And that's simply the way Darwinist social Darwinism or laissez-faire capitalism works. Now, the opposite view came with Karl Marx. And Marx and Engels wanted to dedicate the English version of Das Kapital to Darwin, because, as Marx said, Darwin has given me a biological basis for the class struggle. Well, Darwin rejected the honor, I might add. You could say that Marx was a Darwinist, but Darwin was not a Marxist. But we see this emphasis in other areas, psychology, how man is really just an evolved beast, as Desmond Morris called him, a naked ape. You can see the influence of Darwinism on Freud, and then in a somewhat different way upon Jung and others in psychology. One way that might surprise you is in the area of the way we understand and interpret Scripture, particularly the Old Testament. Now, of course, I'm sure that Andy teaches you here that Moses is the author of the first five books of the Bible, as those books claim he is, and as our Lord Jesus Christ said he was. But in the 1800s, a view developed. It's called the documentary hypothesis, that Moses didn't write those first five books. In fact, they were written by four different authors that we call J, E, D, and P. Andy, am I talking about things that you've already shared with them or not? Okay. And these are the four actual authors. Now, the first one, we call him the J writer, because whenever he refers to God, he always refers to him as Jehovah, or another way of saying Jehovah, Yahweh. But sometimes in the first five books, we see God referred to as Elohim, sometimes as Adonai. Anyway, so obviously that can't be the same author. And so those parts of the Pentateuch, we'll call it, the first five books that refer to God as Jehovah, are by the J writer. Those references to Elohim are by the E writer. And then we have a writer who comes some hundreds of years later, perhaps shortly before the Babylonian exile, and he's the one that revises the Law of Moses into the second statement of the law, Deuteronomy, and so we call him the D writer. And then sometime during or after the exile, there was a priest, the P writer we call him, who took the works of J, E, and D and reorganized them and edited them, maybe redacted a little bit of it, cut some out, maybe added some material of his own. So he is the P writer, the priest. And so that's how the Old Testament came into being. Now, the idea of what we call this documentary hypothesis really has its roots in evolutionary thought. There's a fascinating writer, Herbert Hahn, and his work, The Old Testament and Modern Research, published by Fortress Press. Now, Hahn himself was one of the higher critics. He held this JEDP view, but he was very honest about where it came from. And he says it did not come simply from an objective and intellectual reading of the sources. To a larger extent, he says, it was a reflection of the temper of the times. People already were using evolution to explain everything in other fields of discipline, and it's not surprising that they would apply the Bible to the same kind of evolutionary thought. And what Hahn is saying is that for Graf and Wellhausen, the authors of this theory, that they were thoroughly Darwinian in their worldview, and so for them, it was inconceivable that the early ancestors of the Israelites, like Abraham in 2000 B.C., could have held these lofty monotheistic conceptions of God. They were just too much apes to think of God like that. And so Abraham, what he really believed, and he wouldn't have been referring to God as Jehovah in this view, that would have come much later, but Abraham was simply a tribesman who lived there in Ur of the Chaldees, and They all had their own personal gods that they believed in over there, and there was this God that he identified as Elohim, and later he was referred to as Jehovah. But this God spoke to Abraham, or at least Abraham believed he did, and this God kind of made a special promise to Abraham that if he'd come to some land out in the west there, Canaan, that he would give him land out there, and he would give him descendants, and he would make him a mighty nation there. And anyway, so Abraham didn't think of God as the one true God. This was just his personal God. It's kind of like the way you think about your lawyer. He's not necessarily any better than any other lawyer, but he's your lawyer. And so long as you pay him, he's going to look out for your interests. But no better than any other, really. Well, by the time we get to Moses in the Exodus, now we're down to about 1400 BC, although they'll date it later. Now that we get down to Moses in the Exodus, the concept of God has evolved as man has evolved. And now we see God as not just one of many, but he's the toughest God. He's tougher than any other God in the block. And he can whip all the others. And he can take Aaron's rod and turn it into a serpent. And yes, it's true that the Egyptian priests, their gods can turn their rods into serpents, but our God's greater because Moses' God can swallow the serpent rods of the others, and they're powerless to stop that. So if we are faithful to this God, he's going to go before us in battle and whip the gods of our enemies, and that's going to give us victory. But then as we get down to the time of the exile, by this time man has evolved further, his concept of God has evolved further, and now people believe that he is the only God. And all these others are either demons or non-existent. Joseph Campbell, in his series on mythology, which is pure mythology if you read it, I was disappointed when I got through with it. It doesn't have that much, but he has an idea here and there. He said the main difference between Israel's God and the pagan gods is Israel thought of its God as a fact. Others just thought of their gods as symbols, but to Israel, God was a fact. That's an accurate point of view. Well, what about this JEDP theory? Let me talk about that for just a moment here, because having mentioned it to you, I want you to see just how fallacious the idea really is. This idea that because different writers in the Old Testament use different words for God, that this must mean that they must have been different writers, simply doesn't follow. If you look through all of my writings and see the way I refer to my wife Marlene, by the way, she has a little bit of an identity crisis. Her name is Sophie, Greek word for wisdom, but ever since she was born, they've always called her by her middle name, Marlene. And anyway, so at one time in her life, she was known as Marlene, other times as Sophie, and she's even got a problem now because her birth certificate says Marlene, and her baptismal certificate says Marleen, and we're trying to work that out yet, but it hasn't seemed to be a problem so far. But if I'm just writing a letter to Marlene or an email, I'll just say, "Hi, Marlene." If I'm writing a legal document like a will, I'll probably say Sophie Marlene Eidsmo or Sophie M. Eidsmo. If I'm putting something down like on an airline ticket where she's always been known as Marlene, but they might look to military ID and see Sophie on it, so I might put it down there as S. Marlene Eidsmo. That doesn't mean that these are different writers. It means that I use different words, different names, for different purposes on different occasions. And there's no reason to think that Moses, writing in various places over what could have been 100 years or more, would have reasons to refer to God by different names. Jehovah, for example, is God's name. Elohim is a generic word meaning God. Jews might refer to pagan gods as Elohim. They wouldn't refer to pagan gods as Jehovah, not if they wanted to live very long. In fact, that name was so sacred that it was not even to be pronounced. And among Orthodox, some Orthodox Jews, at least today, they will not even write out the name God. They will say G dash underline D, because many of them still believe that that name is too sacred to even be pronounced. The idea that we see different words used for God here is not at all foreign. It's not strange at all, and it certainly isn't reason to suspect multiple authorship. But we can look to other reasons, and noting, for example, that there are so many marked differences between the Pentateuch and the writings of Babylon or the writings of Egypt that supposedly these were based on. Look to the fact that, contrary to what Wellhausen argued when he said that the Hebrews were illiterate, that there is every reason to believe they were very literate at the time of the Exodus and before. In fact, the Egyptians had a system of writing dating well before 2000 B.C. And Moses was raised in the palace of the Pharaoh. I don't think it's at all unusual to think that Moses at least knew how to read and write. One of the requirements of the Jews was that in many of their rituals that they would perform, the father first and then later the eldest son was to read from the Torah during these ceremonies. And numerous works will tell you that way, way back in the early Old Testament days, Israel had almost universal literacy among boys and very widespread literacy among girls. There are many other ways that I could point out fallacies in this theory. One thing I would point out is how the Jews treasured their scriptures. And certainly one of them would have seen somewhere that somebody had added some things or taken some things out, and there would have been quite a stink raised about that. Nowhere do we see a J source or a D source as something separate. We don't find anything where they are divided. There's a similar theory that the last 26 chapters of Isaiah were written by a third author, or second author called Deutero-Isaiah. He's not Deuteronomy's brother. It means second Isaiah. And then some say even a third. Don't you think some priest would have noticed that and say, hey, somebody's tacked some extra chapters here. What are we going to do about this? The whole theory, when you think about it, is pretty silly. But anyway, this theory is taught as fact in a lot of seminaries today, but it is based squarely on evolutionary thought. Well, it is no wonder, then, that we see evolutionary thought influencing law as well. And as we saw earlier, law, in the view of Blackstone and in the view of our founding fathers, is ordained by God. It is revealed either through the law of nature or through the revealed law, and no human law is of any validity if contrary to that higher law of God. In the 1870s, in particular at Harvard, we see a school of law developing there in contrast to this, the school that we know as legal positivism. The dean of the Harvard Law School, Christopher Columbus Langdell, is one of the main architects of this theory. Likewise, his successor, Roscoe Pound, and one of their star pupils, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who became a justice on the Supreme Court. But they developed a new view of law. And this new view of law essentially has five basic principles that go with it. First of all, that there is no higher law, or if there is, it is entirely irrelevant to our legal system today. Well, if there's no higher law, then where does law come from? That's the second part of the theory, then, that law is man-made. Law is law not because God has said so and man is trying to discover what God has said. Law is law because the highest human authority, the state, has said it as law and has the muscle to back it up. And that is all law is, in the modern view, then, is a rule of conduct backed by governmental force. Third part of the theory, then, is that if man is the author of law and if man is an evolving creature, then law evolves as man evolves. In other words, law changes as man changes. Well, how does law change? Well, here is the fourth part of the theory, then. Judges guide the evolution of law. Law is essentially made by judges. As Thomas Frank says, simply says that whenever a judge decides a case, he is making law. And lawyers will commonly say, as they come out of a court and get a new court precedent set, we just made some law today. Blackstone would have shuddered at that. Blackstone emphasized that judges don't make law. Excuse me. Judges don't make law. Judges simply apply the law that God has established and that has been revealed through the ages. Well, quite a change in the way of thinking. And so the fifth part is what we call the case law method of legal study. Now, what this means is that if you are studying law today, you're not going to simply read Joseph Story on the Constitution or the works of Chancellor Kent or Blackstone or Cook or Bracton or any of the ancient sources. To study law today, you are going to be reading mostly court decisions, because that's the scientific way to get at law. Judges are the makers of law. Law consists of the decisions that judges have made. So to study law, go to the original sources, the decisions of judges. And that's the way law school is conducted today. You spend most of your time in law school reading and reciting and discussing about cases, about decisions that judges have made. Well, there's another theory that begins to come in at this time, too, in the late 1800s, and that's what I'll describe as the New Age movement. We begin to hear that term particularly in probably about the 1980s, but you could possibly date that movement back a long time before that to Madame Blavatsky in the late 1800s and the Theosophist or Wisdom of God movement. And in this view, truth is subjective. That is, truth is what you want it to be. You create your own truth. As one New Age thinker, Isaac Bonowitz, had put it, that there are an infinite number of universes out there, and you can live in whichever universe or scheme of reality you choose. Kind of like channel surfing on television. You look to the various screens, and if you don't find a program you like, well, in this view, you could just simply create your own scheme of reality and live in that. What matters is not whether something is objectively true, because there is no objective truth. What matters is whether it is true to you. Now think about that and what that does to the whole concept of justice. Aristotle had defined justice as rendering to each person what is due. Well, how do we know what's due to a person? In order to know that, you've got to get at the truth. Did the person commit the crime or didn't he? And if he did, are there extenuating or mitigating circumstances that we need to consider in passing sentence? In order to know all this, we need to know the truth. You can't do justice apart from truth. Well, if there is no such thing as objective truth, if truth is merely subjective, merely in your state of mind, then how can there be such a thing as justice? And why does it matter? It changes the whole concept around. And like the story once about the baseball umpires who had met and had a conversation, and one of them said, well, I try to practice integrity. I call them as they are. That's an objective view of reality. Next one said, well, I try to call them as they are, but, well, I do my best. I call them as I see them. And that's not too bad. There, we're recognizing that an objective reality out there does exist as to whether that's a ball or a strike, but we also recognize that our ability to apprehend that objective reality may be somewhat limited, but at least there's an objective reality out there. Then comes the third one, and he said, they ain't nothing until I calls them. That is the postmodern or New Age view of truth. Stories told about the math teachers who got together, and The classical math teacher said, I don't understand all this new math, all this fuzzy math. I have always taught my students that 8 minus 4 equals 4 and always has and always will. And then the Darwinian math teacher came along and said, well, I don't teach it that way because I have a more relative view of truth itself, and I teach that 8 minus 4 used to equal 4, but through a process of natural selection, the 4 evolved into a 5. The Hegelian math teacher said, well, I teach that there was originally a thesis that 8 minus 4 equaled 4, but then an antithesis arose that 8 minus 4 equals 6, and out of that came a synthesis that 8 minus 4 equals 5. And then the New Age and postmodern math teacher said, I don't teach my students that 8 minus 4 equals anything. I have them write an essay telling how the number 8 feels about having 4 subtracted from it. Well, you might notice that the president, when he announced his first selection for the Supreme Court, Judge Sonia Sotomayor, said that one of the main qualities that he was looking for in judges and justices was empathy. Well, I'm sorry, but that is not a quality that we look for in a judge. A prosecutor, maybe. A judge is supposed to be blind. That picture that you see of justice blindfolded means that the judge, not that he's blind to the facts, but that he blindly applies the law to the facts regardless of the people involved. Doesn't show favoritism to the rich. Doesn't show favoritism to the poor. Anyway, that's the concept of justice that we're supposed to have. But you get into the New Age view, and how can there be such a thing at all? We look to the postmodern idea today, where one aspect of it is what we call language deconstruction. Language deconstruction means that words do not express ultimate reality. Words are mere social constructs. And they might be very much restricted by the values that we place on them. And in the view of language deconstruction, when you're reading literature, it doesn't really matter what the author intended. Doesn't really matter what the dictionary says the words mean. What matters is what they mean to you, the reader. Now, if you have a very classic view of this, and you're a drama producer, let's say, and you're producing Romeo and Juliet, you'll try to produce it as faithfully to the way Shakespeare conceived it as you possibly can. If you are a postmodern New Age drama producer, you'll probably change it into something like a modern West Side Story or something like this and put all your own ideas into it, because it's what you have in your ideas that count, not what the author thought. How do you apply that idea then to the practice of law? How does a judge who has been steeped and trained in postmodernism all his life, how does he start interpreting the law and the Constitution? Well, I'm going to suggest something that I think you'll find really interesting here. I'd like to read something from Woodrow Wilson. I'm going to just kind of take a few excerpts from this. He wrote a book titled The New Freedom, and you may recall that he had been the president of Princeton prior to becoming president of the United States, and a lot of people don't realize in his philosophy how liberal Woodrow Wilson really was and how his thought foreshadowed a lot of liberal thought 100 years later. But he describes a man who came and lectured at Princeton one time and talked about how engrossing that lecture was, and he said, he called my attention to the fact that in every generation, all sorts of speculation and thinking tend to fall under the formula of the dominant thought of the age. For example, after the Newtonian theory of the universe had been developed, almost all thinking tended to express itself in the analogies of Newtonian theory. You know, the idea of absolute laws that never change. And since the Darwinian theory has reigned among us, everybody is likely to express whatever he wishes to expound in terms of development and accommodation to environment. He says, now it came to me as this interesting man talked that the Constitution of the United States had been made under the dominion of the Newtonian theory. You have only to read the papers of the Federalists to see that fact written on every page. They speak of the checks and balances of the Constitution and use to express their idea the simile of the organization of the universe, and particularly of the solar system, how by the attraction of gravity the various parts are held in their orbits, and they proceed to represent Congress, the judiciary, and the president as a sort of imitation of the solar system. He goes on to say, the trouble with the theory is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its tasks, shaped to its functions by the sheer pressure of life. No living thing can have its organs offset against each other like checks and balances and live. On the contrary, its life is dependent on their quick cooperation, their ready response to commands of instinct or intelligence, their amicable community of purpose. And then he goes on to say, living political constitutions must be Darwinian in structure and in practice. Society is a living organism and must obey the laws of life, not of mechanics. It must develop. All that progressives ask or desire is permission in an era when development, evolution, is the scientific word, to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. All they ask is recognition of the fact that a nation is a living thing and not a machine. Well, you see where he's going. We spoke about this a little bit last night. I'm going to try to enlarge on that now. But in the early days of our constitutional republic, judges disagreed on how to interpret the Constitution, and usually their disagreement ranged between those who favored strict construction and those who favored broad construction. John Marshall, for example, favored a broad construction of the Constitution, and Thomas Jefferson favored a narrow construction. They were distant relatives, they never got along, and anyway, they attacked each other quite a bit. But the idea of broad construction versus narrow construction, a good example of how we would look at these, both of them are trying to look back to the how you'd interpret the framers' intent. There was a case in the 1930s, Olmsted versus United States. It dealt with wiretapping a telephone. And anyway, person who was convicted because of something he had said about a criminal enterprise on the telephone, and this isn't too long after telephones had become widespread, of course, but he objected to his introduction in court, saying that nobody had a right to listen into that telephone conversation, because he said that is an unreasonable search and seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Well, the majority on the court at that time disagreed, and they said, search and seizure, that means picking up people and arresting them, or looking in files, or looking in drawers, looking and seizing things. Listening to a telephone conversation, that's not a search or a seizure. That's just listening in. Besides that, how can you possibly expect to have any privacy there? You're talking on some device that's got a wire connected to it, and with that enables you to project your voice where you can be heard by somebody maybe all the way across town even. And that's not a thing to be searched or seized. That's not what the Fourth Amendment is all about. And so they rejected Olmsted's claim. But one justice dissented. I recall correctly, it was Holmes. And he argued in that dissent that the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. And it protects them where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, some 30 years later, we have another case, Katz versus United States. This involves a man who was making a telephone call to do some illegal booking for illegal gambling operations, and he did it in a phone booth. And The court looked at that, and the question was, did he have a reasonable expectation of privacy? They looked back to the dissenting opinion earlier with Olmsted and said, it protects persons, not places. And so, yes, a telephone conversation could be one in which you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, yes, but he made it in a glass telephone booth. That's true, the court said, but what he has privacy in is not against the eye, but against the uninvited ear. So he had a reasonable expectation that his conversation, even in a glass phone booth, would be considered private. And so the wiretapping was illegal. Not that they couldn't do it, but they'd have to get a search warrant before they could do it. And Justice Black dissented there. He said, again, that's not what search and seizure was all about. That's eavesdropping. And eavesdropping is not what the Founding Fathers were talking about. They could have prohibited that, but they didn't. Well, what we're talking about here is the difference between strict construction and loose construction. Those who said that listening to a telephone conversation was not wiretapping were looking to the literal words at the time. And if you had asked Madison on the floor of Congress when the Fourth Amendment was proposed, well, when you say search and seizure, do you mean to include telephone wiretaps? He would have looked at you like, what planet did you come from? The words don't suggest telephone conversations. But the dissenting opinion there, and then the majority in Katz, they're saying the intent of the framers is important, but we look to not just their literal intent, but what were they intending to protect? They were intending to protect people's reasonable expectation of privacy. And sure, they knew nothing about telephones at that time, but if you could take James Madison and set him down in today's society and let him see telephones and so on, would he have intended that that be covered by his Fourth Amendment? Again, you're not denying that the intent of the framers is important, but you look to the values behind that intent rather than to reading it literally. That's the dispute between strict and broad construction. And my own view is original intent, look to the framers' intent, and when you look to the Constitution, I think you have to say there are some parts of it that they intended to have a very narrow construction, and there are probably some parts that they intended to have a broader construction. But as Attorney General Meese once said, at that time, the question was between loose and strict construction. Now, it is not how to interpret the Constitution, it is whether to interpret the Constitution. Today, the issue is not how do we look to the framers' intent. Today, the issue is, does the framers' intent matter at all? And if you hold this New Age postmodern view of truth, that everything is subjective and all that really matters is the eye of the beholder, then obviously in that view, the intent of the framer doesn't matter a bit. Well, you can see what a subjective view of the Constitution then becomes. It becomes a view where the Constitution is a ball of wax, as Jefferson said, that each judge can interpret to mean whatever he wants it to mean. And we can look to areas, in fact, we were talking about some of these areas earlier, well, yesterday, I guess it was, where the Supreme Court has taken the Commerce Clause, that Congress has the authority to regulate interstate commerce, and I always tell my students that there are three ends that it can regulate: interstate commerce, international commerce, and Indian commerce. But it cannot regulate intrastate commerce, commerce within a state. Gradually, the court began to expand the concept of interstate commerce to include anything that is substantially affected by interstate commerce. For example, in 1937, we have a decision, Jones and Laughlin Steel versus the National Labor Relations Board. And in this case, the question is whether the National Labor Relations Board can come in and force arbitration on a strike that is going on in Jones and Laughlin Steel. And Jones argues, bug off, you have no authority over us. a labor strike, a labor dispute taking place in our company is not interstate commerce at all. It is local production, not interstate commerce, and you have no authority to regulate us. Well, the Supreme Court, in what's probably one of the 8 or 10 most significant court decisions the court ever decided, the Supreme Court in this 5-4 decision said, yes, Congress does have the authority to regulate you through the National Relations Board. You see, unresolved labor disputes in the steel industry could lead to strikes. Strikes could lead to a shutdown of steel production. A shutdown in steel production could disrupt the flow of steel in interstate commerce. Therefore, if it is necessary in order to preserve the flow of steel in interstate commerce to regulate local production, Congress has the authority to regulate local production. We were talking about a case, I think that was at dinner last night, was it? The Wickard versus Filburn case. This is a few years later in something like 1942. By this time, the remaining conservatives have left the court, and the court's, in my opinion, totally in fantasy land at this point. But here you have Congress putting in some restrictions on production of grain by farmers. In other words, the idea here is that we're in a depression, and prices are depressed, and the reason is that we have an oversupply of grain, so if we can cut down grain production, that will diminish the supply. If the demand remains the same and supply goes down, the price is going to rise, and that will get the farmers out of the depression. They didn't have Prozac to get them out of depression then, so they had to look to things like this. But anyway, so one particular farmer named Filburn in Ohio was limited to producing grain on 23 acres. Well, he raised more grain on other acres as well in violation of the act. And as a result of this, he was prosecuted, and he defended, saying, all of the excess grain that I raised, I fed to my own livestock on my own farm. Now, how can you possibly say that the grain that I raise on my own farm and feed to my own livestock is interstate commerce? Well, the court said, that's easy. You see, if you hadn't raised any of that excess grain, then you would have had to feed the rest of your grain to your livestock, and you would have had less to sell at the elevator in interstate commerce, so that would have affected interstate commerce. Or if you had sold all of your grain to interstate commerce there at the elevator, then you would have had to buy feed at the feedlot. And that would have affected interstate commerce. So either way, you have affected interstate commerce. And certainly you can see where everything affects anything, but you can see what a broad stretch that is from what the framers meant when they spoke about interstate commerce. One of the areas that I would look to especially is Roe versus Wade, the decision of the United States Supreme Court in which they struck down the abortion law of Texas and the abortion laws of nearly all other states at the same time, a 1973 decision, 7-2, with Rehnquist and White dissenting. But what they said was that these abortion laws violate the constitutional right to have an abortion. Problem is, you don't find that right mentioned in the Constitution. So where did it come from? Well, Justice Blackmun, in that majority opinion, essentially says, well, I can't put my finger on it, but it's got to be in there somewhere. I'm exaggerating a little, but to look to exactly what he says there are certain rights in the Bill of Rights that have emanations. And these emanations that flow from these rights form penumbras. Now, there is a word that most people wouldn't bother looking up. It means a shadow or an aura. Essentially, he seems to be saying that he has a special kind of glasses that were issued to him when he came to the court, and apparently Rehnquist and White never got those glasses. But as he reads the Constitution, he sees these emanations flowing from the words into the margins and between the paragraphs and coalescing, and There he sees things like privacy and the like, and anyway, there is where he gets this idea of a right to abortion. Well, the problem is, once you start interpreting the Constitution according to emanations and penumbras, any objective study of the Constitution becomes impossible. It can mean anything anybody wants it to mean when you start using a subjective standard like that. What's interesting is the way this came about so gradually, just a step at a time. Back in the early 1960s, we had a case, Griswold versus Connecticut, and it involved the question of a Connecticut statute that prohibited birth control, and Connecticut at that time was quite heavily Roman Catholic, which is one of the reasons for the prohibition. But anyway, the argument was made there by Griswold that this is unconstitutional. It violates a right to privacy. Now, as he made that argument before the Supreme Court, his attorney, a professor by the name of Thomas Emerson, was asked by Justice Black on the court, this right of privacy that you're talking about, would you say this would extend to abortion? And Professor Emerson said, and this is right on the transcript from the proceeding, no, it would not extend that far. I am talking about a right that exists within the home and within the context of marriage. Abortion would not be done in the home and is therefore outside the concept of privacy. Well, just a few years later, in Cantwell versus Connecticut, Eisenberg, I believe it was, not Cantwell, but just a few years later, the court expands the concept of birth control to include single people as well as married. Black dissents from this, and as Black dissents, he says, I don't think the state should be prohibiting birth control, especially among married people, but whether I think so or not is irrelevant unless you can show me where the Constitution prohibits it. If the Constitution doesn't prohibit it, then it is up to the Congress to decide whether or not, or the state legislature to decide whether or not birth control or anything like that should be legal. Or if we think it should have constitutional protection, then we should amend the Constitution to include that protection. But we don't just simply stretch the Constitution to mean something it doesn't mean. Unfortunately, that was a dissenting opinion. And within just a few years after that, just a decade later, the court has now expanded this concept of privacy to include not only birth control, but to include abortion as well. And then, three decades after that, to include the right to engage in homosexual conduct. Well, you see just how far the court is going afield from what the intent of the framers was. And as I said last night, the same court that can read rights into the Constitution that are not there can also read rights out of the Constitution that are there. When you think about it, it's a very dangerous concept. And I look back to a real origin of this, and I suggest a lot of it comes out of Lewis Carroll. Remember Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass? And you might remember that often quoted exchange between Alice and Humpty Dumpty, and Humpty Dumpty said, now there is a nice knockdown, drag-out argument for you. And Alice said, well, I don't think that can be called a knockdown, drag-out argument. Humpty Dumpty answers, when I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean, nothing more and nothing less. And Alice asks, the question is, can you make words mean different things? A very perceptive question. And Humpty Dumpty answers, the question is, who is to be master? That is all. Think about it. If judges are free to make the words of the Constitution mean whatever they want them to mean, then judges have become our masters, and the limits upon their powers become virtually non-existent. The court once said by Justice Felix Frankfurter, Frankfurter was by no means a conservative, but he was faithful to the intent of the Constitution, and he was critical of the court expanding the Constitution beyond its meaning, and he once said, what governs is the Constitution and not what we have written about it. Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, though, gave an opposite perspective, and you think about it, it's not only wrong, it is downright dangerous. He said, "We are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. It ain't nothing until I call it." That's not only a dangerous view of the constitution, it's a dangerous view of truth. Justice Hugo Black, the only justice to come out of Alabama, was not a conservative in many respects, but he was one who looked at the Constitution, if you pardon the expression, black and white, took everything exactly as it was. Story is told, and it's supposed to be true, that the law clerk for another justice said to a clerk of Justice Black, "The trouble with your justice is he thinks he can understand the Constitution just by reading it." Well, it is too bad we don't get back to that concept, and even though he wasn't conservative, there are a lot of parallels between Black's thinking and Justice Scalia's thinking today. Both of them are very black and white in the way they interpret the Constitution. Well, one of the results of this type of thinking is that when we look to federal decisions today, first of all, there are a lot more of them than there used to be. In fact, if you go to the Supreme Court Law Library and you look to the U.S. reporters, you will find that the ones for the last couple of decades will take more space on the shelves than the ones for the previous two centuries combined. It is incredible the way they've mushroomed. And that's usually true despite the fact that there's finer paper and finer print on the recent ones than on the early ones. Another is there are a lot longer decisions. What is amazing is you read these earlier decisions, Marbury versus Madison, McCulloch versus Maryland and others, is how succinct they are, how clearly and carefully and systematically they state their points. A third is the authorities they cite. In the earlier decisions, we see citations frequently directly to the Constitution or to federal statutes, or maybe citations to treatises like Chancellor Kent's Treatise on American Law, or going back to Blackstone and the like. Today, what you find is the main authority cited by federal judges in their decisions is other decisions by other federal judges. In other words, the federal judiciary has almost become a law unto itself. Well, all of this, I think, has become a very dangerous concept. It means that we have been taken over by this theory of evolution and this view of the Constitution that this theory of evolution entails. And with it, the concept of limited government is very much up for grabs today and at risk. Likewise, our basic freedoms are subject to whatever the judges wishes to make out of them at any time, whether they wish to expand them or contract them or limit them entirely. Again, a Darwinian constitution is no protection for anybody. We need to interpret the Constitution as an enduring constitution, and that means interpret it according to the view of law and the view of truth that our founding fathers held, the view that it is in fact the truth of God.